Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Professor Alexander Nemirov for Outlandish Life, Peter Paul Rubens and the Baroque, exploring the dramatic art of the 17th century. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
Trump rambled about Americans from Somalia. He also talked of deporting a U.S. citizen, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. The congresswoman responds in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, San Francisco's mayor chooses a new police chief. I'm Brian Watt.
The president fired another batch of immigration judges. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The judges resolve immigration cases, deciding if people should be deported. So why is the deportation president firing so many? Also, Lucy Liu takes on a lead role in a movie about how far a mother will go to protect her son. It's Thursday, December 4th. This day in 1956, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Carl Perkins walked into a recording studio. Their jam session became the Million Dollar Quartet. The news is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Hurst. The presidents of Congo and Rwanda are in Washington today, where they're due to sign a historic peace agreement. The Trump administration brokered the deal, hoping to solve long-standing conflict in eastern Congo. But fighting on the ground has continued, as Emmett Livingstone reports.
The Congolese President Felix Tshisekedi and Rwandan leader Paul Kagame are due at the newly renamed Donald J. Trump Institute for Peace in Washington, where they'll sign off on a peace agreement between their countries. While there's some optimism that the U.S. brokered peace initiative will yield results, that hope is slim. Congo and Rwanda already agreed to the deal over the summer, but it's hardly been implemented. Heavy fighting with M23 rebels in eastern Congo continued this week. It's a tense but symbolic moment. Tshisekedi and Kagame are bitter enemies. Earlier this year, the two African countries nearly descended into war after M23 rebels, who are backed by Rwanda, captured eastern Congo's two largest cities. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
A two-day CDC advisory panel meets today on whether newborns should still get the hepatitis B vaccine, the first shot found to prevent cancer. Current health recommendations suggest all babies be vaccinated at birth, but Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s committee is expected to vote to change that. NPR's Ping Wong has more.
First of all, the group is going to be voting on whether to drop the recommendation that hepatitis B vaccines be given to babies at birth. This is a policy that's been in effect for more than 30 years. Also, they're going to be discussing the overall vaccine schedule, which is who gets which vaccines and when, and also what goes into vaccines.
A dozen former leaders of the FDA are warning that the proposed changes to the current vaccine schedule could put the nation's health at risk and undermine public trust in the health system. Activist groups across southeast Louisiana are conducting trainings as the federal immigration crackdown in New Orleans is underway. Report for America Corps member Alex Cox has more.
Dozens gathered at a church in Baton Rouge for a workshop on filming immigration and customs enforcement officers legally and peacefully. The group OHOS had attendees role play as bystanders, people without legal status, and ICE agents. Organizer Rachel Tabor says encounters with law enforcement can be uncomfortable, even dangerous, so it's important to practice in advance.
It's important to teach our constitutional rights to all of us because we cannot live free unless we actually use our rights.
The federal government is calling the operation Catahoula Crunch. In a press release, the Department of Homeland Security says the operation is targeting violent criminals. From NPR News, I'm Alex Cox in Baton Rouge.
Wall Street is trading in mixed territory at this hour. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco, where Derek Liu is officially the city's new police chief. Mayor Daniel Lurie appointed the San Francisco native to the post yesterday, replacing interim police chief Paul Yep. Liu has worked for the department for nearly 20 years, most recently serving as deputy chief. Public safety advocates with Stop Crime SF say they're pleased with the selection. Here's Frank Noto, the group's president.
He's going to be a community-oriented police chief, interacting and communicating with everybody from neighborhood associations to small merchants groups, and is going to be answerable to the community.
Lou was previously captain of the city's Ingleside station. State Attorney General Rob Bonta says a recent wave of shootings in Northern California shows that California's strict gun laws don't make the state immune to the national gun violence crisis. Speaking Wednesday, Bonta said a lack of federal intervention allows guns to easily cross borders into California from states with less strict laws.
California is a blueprint for what all states should do, what the federal government should do if we are serious about tackling gun violence. If every state did what California is doing, if the United States did what California is doing, we would save tens of thousands of more lives from gun violence.
His remarks came just a day after a student was shot at a San Francisco high school and follows a mass shooting in Stockton last weekend that left four dead, as well as recent campus shootings in Oakland. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Morning support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, in movie theaters starting December 5th. And the listeners of KQED. Mel returns with traffic, an update on a morning crash in San Jose.
Yeah, 280 northbound just after McLaughlin Avenue. A several vehicle crashed, now moved to the shoulder. Traffic is stop and go to the 680-101 exchange. It's backing up on southbound 680 toward King. Meanwhile, this big gravel truck problem here on northbound 101 before Hellier Avenue. The truck has been removed. The gravel remains, but they've been able to clear the left lane. The three right lanes remain blocked. No word on when they'll finally be able to clear the entire thing. And 101 in northbound before Blossom Hill Road, the center lane blocked by a traffic accident involving a pickup truck. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support for Mel Baker comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Ahead, Brian Watt with your KQED news at 8:22. The Oakland Police Department has pledged to boost the number of women in its ranks, but the agency has fallen short of that goal. What's driving the trend? More ahead on KQED News on this Thursday. Some sun ahead around the Bay Area, not as windy today. Some areas of morning fog existing that should burn off later. Highs in the low 50s to the mid-60s around the Bay Area. Coastal flood advisory still in effect for the King Tides through Sunday afternoon.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Representative Ilhan Omar for her response to remarks by President Trump about her and many of her constituents. For 2 days in a row, the president has gone on racist tirades against the Somali community in Minnesota.
The Somalians should be out of here. They've destroyed our country. And all they do is complain, complain, complain.
In a ramble that went on for several minutes on Wednesday, the president talked about Somalis as a group, including many citizens who employ him. Trump also talked about deporting Omar, a U.S. citizen who is a member of Congress. In the middle of his discussion, he threw in a mention of former President Obama, although Trump did not say what he thought Obama and Somalis might have in common. He was following up on Tuesday's ramble when he discussed Somalis and others convicted of defrauding social service programs in Minnesota.
We're going to go the wrong way if we keep taking in garbage into our country. Ilhan Omar is garbage. She's garbage. Her friends are garbage. These aren't people that work. These aren't people that say, let's go, come on, let's make this place great.
NPR's Mara Liasson is here to tell us more about all this. Good morning, Mara.
Good morning.
So, you know, Mara, we've heard Trump target immigrant groups before, from the first day of his first campaign for president, in fact. But calling an entire community of people garbage, I mean, is there something different here?
Yes. I think even by Trump's standards of nativism and xenophobia, these attacks were pretty harsh. You know, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar has been one of Trump's favorite targets for quite some time. He belittled her on social media recently, saying she's, quote, always wrapped in her swaddling hijab. He's told her to go back where she came from, even though she's an American citizen. And this does come, as you say, at a time when there's this big financial scandal in Minnesota. Federal prosecutors have convicted or indicted dozens of people for defrauding cutting social services funding totaling hundreds of millions of dollars, according to Minnesota Public Radio. Most of those convicted are of Somali descent. The vast majority of Somalis in the Minneapolis region are U.S. citizens, but the situation has provided the chance for Trump to attack Omar and the entire Somali community, and here's what he said.
They contribute nothing. The welfare is like 88%. They contribute nothing. I don't want them in our country, I'll be honest with you.
So let me just say here that there's no evidence of that what he said is accurate. But having said that, what do you think he gains from this?
I think this has been a tried and true tactic for him for over the last 10 years, these nativist attacks. I think they attract attention. They can distract from problems he's having. You know, he denigrated Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals during the 2024 campaign. He and J.D. Vance repeated false rumors that Haitian immigrants were eating cats and dogs.
Could it be that he's also lashing out because he's frustrated? I mean, his approval ratings are low. He has not achieved a number of the things that he claimed he was going to achieve, including peace in Ukraine, etc. And I just wonder if this part of the way he reacts to situations where he's not doing well.
I think that's right. His approval ratings are low. His base is solid, but independents give him a 25% approval rating, and Republicans are going to need those independent voters in the 2026 elections. Maybe they would rather have him bring prices down than attack immigrants.
So we don't know whether this is going to continue. As we mentioned, this has gone on for a couple of days now. The president is meeting with some African leaders today. How do you think that's going to go?
Well, they're not from Somalia. They're from Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo. They're here to sign a U.S.-brokered peace deal. Trump is taking credit for solving the conflict between these two countries, and he's adding this to a long list of wars he claims to have ended. It's all part of him making the case for why he should get the Nobel Peace Prize.
That is NPR's Mara Liasson. Mara, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, what do Somali Americans think of all this? We begin in St. Cloud, Minnesota, with Minnesota Public Radio's Kirsty Marone.
About 100 people crammed into a meeting room at the St. Cloud Public Library. A sign on the podium read, "An attack on one is an attack on all." 27-year-old Faisa Omar opened the event with a song.
America, America, God shed his grace on me.
Most of the Somalis in this area are U.S. citizens, either born here or naturalized, or are legal permanent residents. Many in the room said when they heard President Trump say that Somalis are garbage and contribute nothing, they felt the need to fight back. Abdi Kadir Bashir is executive director of the Center for African Immigrants and Refugees Organization.
We're not here tonight because we're afraid. We're here because we refuse to be silent.
Bashir said Trump's words don't define the Somali people.
Here is our message to your hate, Mr. President. You cannot defeat people who have already survived wars. We will outlast your trash talk.
Some said the national scrutiny and talk of a possible immigration crackdown in Minnesota are creating fear and anxiety. Farhia Iman, a behavioral health professional, says it's important for people to know there's more to the Somali community than the negative news stories.
We're just as American as anybody else. We're trying to raise children. We want them to be productive members of society. We want to be successful. There's a lot that goes into being Somali than just what the headlines say.
Mahmoud Mohammed was one of the first Somalis to come to St. Cloud in 1999 after fleeing that country's civil war.
We came from a destroyed country by war. It's not a choice. It's not a choice. It's a necessity.
Mohammed voted for Trump twice, but says he now regrets it. He says the president is unfairly blaming Somalis when the vast majority are hardworking and law-abiding. For NPR News, I'm Kirsty Marone in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
For more on President Trump's comments about the Somali community, we're joined by Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She's represented Minnesota's 5th congressional district since 2019. She is a Democrat who came to the U.S. from Somalia when she was 12 and is, of course, now an American citizen and represents the largest Somali American community in the country. Welcome, Congresswoman. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me.
You've been a favorite target of President Trump since you were elected, but it cannot have been easy to hear him make these comments about the entire Somali community. I just wondered what went through your mind when he said things like they contribute nothing and should go back to where they came from and so on.
his vile rant really wasn't a surprise to me. He has trafficked in racism, in xenophobia, in bigotry, in Islamophobia for as long as he has held office. This was a president who called African nations countries. This is a president that when he was running for re-election said Haitians were eating cats and dogs. And so for me, I mostly feel shame. I feel shame for him. I feel shame for our country. When he does these kind of unhinged rants, he showcases to not just all Americans, but to the world that we elected just a really crazy, deranged old man who does not have the ability to control himself.
As you noted, making derogatory comments about immigrants has been part of the president's political brand, political profile, if you will, from the beginning. But do you have a theory about why his focus is now on Somalis?
Well, I believe that he's always trying to find a way to deflect attention whenever he is under scrutiny. And we know that in this moment, he and his Secretary of Defense are being accused of possibly committing war crimes. We are seeing the jobs numbers not living up to the promises that he made. We are seeing the American people feel the rise of costs on goods. We've heard him try to force and oversee the pedophile protection party in trying to protect the Epstein files. And so he's got a litany of things that he doesn't want to answer for. What he doesn't understand is that our community is not one to be intimidated or scapegoated.
Along with these comments, there are multiple news reports suggesting that the administration is expected to carry out ICE operations in Somali neighborhoods. Now, that head of immigration enforcement says that these neighborhoods aren't being targeted, but that they are going to pursue people with removal orders, etc. What are you telling people? What are you saying to your constituents?
You know, Somali Minnesotans have been preparing. We knew that when he got into office that he wasn't just going to go after people who are undocumented, that he was actually going to go after immigrants in general and possibly American citizens. There is a lot of chaos. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of noise. But the community is getting the support it needs, and it feels like it's on a playing field that they feel protected.
This is also taking place, though, at a time when there are reports of widespread fraud involving social service programs in Minnesota. According to prosecutors, as reported in a story in the New York Times, like all but 8 of the 86 people charged in 3 different fraud cases, one involving meals, one involving housing, one involving autism therapy, are of Somali ancestry. So I have 2 questions about that. First of all, do you have any reaction to that information?
Well, I'm grateful that, you know, we have laws that bring accountability to the taxpayers that have been defrauded, and they are going to jail for a really long time.
Do you have a theory about why it is that such a large percentage of the people implicated in these cases are of Somali ancestry?
I'm sure that we will learn from a lot of the cases that have gone to court on why they were able to, you know, commit the fraud.
Are you concerned that an entire community is being scapegoated because of the actions of this group of people?
It is. It's shameful in many ways because, you know, we are a country that believes the crime of one is not the crime of many. And, you know, these are people who are being prosecuted, and it is not fair to scapegoat the whole Somali community of whom have been law-abiding and grateful people that have chosen to make Minnesota their home.
That is Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. She's a Democrat from Minnesota. Congresswoman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is NPR News.
On member-supported KQED on this Thursday at 8:19. KQED News with Brian Watt is forthcoming. Now let's go to Mel Baker for a North Bay traffic update.
Yeah, 101 southbound before Highway 37, a rollover crash blocking the 2 left lanes. It is pretty much stopped back to Roland Boulevard, moving over to Burlingame, 101 southbound before Broadway. Traffic is stopped back to the SFO exit after an SUV crash that's now on the shoulder. In Sunol, 680 southbound before 84 west. Second lane from the left blocked by a two-car crash. It is backed up to Castlewood Drive. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thursday traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from John Muir Health, offering comprehensive cancer care with a team approach and advanced treatment options at the UCSF John Muir Health, Gene and Ken Hoffman Cancer Center in Walnut Creek. Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com. Join us for Forum coming up at 9 o'clock, discussing the Trump administration's pausing of all asylum immigration decisions, what this sweeping change means for legal immigrants, asylum seekers, and the federal agencies that carry out deportations. More on Forum, that's at the top of the hour, at 9 on KQED News.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. Russia is throwing cold water on the latest effort to end the war in Ukraine. We'll speak with Russia expert Fiona Hill, who served on the U.S. National Security Council. We'll ask what it's going to take to end that quagmire next time on Here and Now.
And that, of course, Here and Now, after Forum at 11 today on KQED News. Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters December 12th. Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. And the listeners and members of KQED. On Thursday morning, the time coming up on 8:22 now.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. The Oakland Police Department needs more women officers. It signed on to take measures to boost the number of women in its ranks 4 years ago, but as KQED's Alex Hall reports, the department is struggling to meet that objective.
POT Mitchell, requesting permission to speak to Officer Ramos and DT staff.
One early morning in late September, eight men and women lined up in a back room of OPD's downtown headquarters. They were recruits with Oakland's 195th Police Academy doing their morning warm-up.
Three, begin. One,
two, sir.
Three, four,
sir.
Five, six, sir.
Kimberly Galvan was one of three women in the class at the time. She recalled how, growing up in Oakland, there was a male officer who had a positive influence on her. But
I didn't have any female role models in law enforcement.
As an adult, she said she was drawn to public service and became an OPD dispatcher. But as she answered 911 calls and heard female officers responding, it occurred to her, why not become a police officer herself?
I don't see them, but I hear their voices. I hear what they're responding to every day. And it inspired me, honestly, to be able to want to take that next step in doing this.
6 weeks later, Galvan was no longer in the academy. An OPD spokesperson said she did not pass one of the training courses required, but she enrolled in the next training, which started last month. In 2021, OPD signed on to the 30 by 30 initiative, a nationwide push to improve the representation and experiences of women in law enforcement. Since then, the department has created a lactation space for staff, and it's developing workshops for women interested in jobs with the department. But despite those efforts, the representation of female officers at OPD, 15%, remains pretty much the same 4 years later. OPD Sergeant of Police for the department's recruiting and background unit said that's likely due to attrition, Oakland's budgeted reduction in sworn staffing levels, and the recent hiring freeze. Mary Dodge is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Colorado, Denver.
I'm not at all surprised by the 15% number.
She says that OPD's figure lines up with statistics at the national level.
Changing that despite all the research we have and everything that says that women make good officers, they can do the job as well as men, nothing changes.
Mo McGough, founder of 30 by 30, says part of what the initiative does is help agencies tell an accurate story about the knowledge, skills, and abilities that are associated with effective policing.
Based on the strength of the research, we're really confident that as agencies do that, they'll naturally see an increase in the number of women who are drawn to the profession and the number of women who pass assessments.
But breaking into the field can still be daunting.
The image of this law enforcement doesn't look like me. It doesn't look like a single mom.
That's Veronica. She recently took the Berkeley Police Department's physical agility test and didn't pass. KQED isn't disclosing her last name, so she can speak freely about the hiring process without harming her job prospects.
You have to keep telling yourself what you're doing it for, because it's easy to get knocked off the block.
Veronica says she always wanted to become a homicide detective, but staying motivated has been hard. She's dealt with discouragement from people around her, including male family members.
You go into a place where it's like nothing but men. You're looking at them like, no, maybe they were right. Maybe I don't belong here. Oh, you belong in business suits and heels. And it's like, that's not what I want to do.
As she prepares to apply to other academies, she says it's helped being exposed to women who have done the job and succeeded, including Margaret Dixon.
But students come in here, we have literature out here for them. They can come and they can ask questions. They come
on a recent fall afternoon, Dixon walked through a Merritt College office where recruitment brochures from employers like the San Francisco Sheriff's Office and CHP were on display. Dixon is an advisor to the Administration of Justice program here, where she mentors young women interested in careers in policing, corrections, and the law. Dixon herself completed OPD's Police Academy in 1980. She worked for the department for 25 years.
It's the best decision I could have made. And so that's why I'm so positive about really trying to get other women to do it, because I think if they get into it and see what they can bring to the job, they'll be happy that they did.
When it comes to recruiting and retaining women, Dixon believes OPD could be doing more, like inviting women to tour the department and meet female officers.
A lot of women feel that way, that, oh, it's a male-dominant job, so I won't even go and try it until you see other women who say, no, you know, you can do this. You can do this, and let me show you how you can do it and be successful at it.
But it's not just OPD, she says. The profession as a whole needs to show women law enforcement is a field where they belong. I'm Alex Hall, KQED News.
The king tides forecast across the Bay Area are at their highest today, which could mean flooding along coastal communities. Scientists get valuable data from that, as well as the flip side of king tides later in the day. KQED's Ezra David Romero explains.
King tides take place when the sun and moon are both at their closest to Earth. And when this happens, tides rise and push water onto land. Parts of Highway 101 in Marin County often flood during these events, as do places like San Rafael and San Francisco's Embarcadero. Annie Kohut-Frankel with the California King Tides Project is asking the public to photograph the king tides this week. She says the images will help scientists understand future sea level rise.
They may see a beach that's underwater or a road that's flooded, and they can think about how in the near future that beach or that road may be flooded every day.
King tides happen several times a year. Another round is set to take place in early January. On the flip side, king tides are super low in the evening. Erin Hubach says that's a perfect time to go tide pooling. She's with the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
There will be more tide pools exposed, and oftentimes there are certain animals, certain fish, maybe even octopuses.
King tides are forecast through the weekend. Hubach says to take caution, wear non-slip boots, and always look out for sneaky waves. I'm Ezra David Romero, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Let's listen to Mel Baker. He has more about the king tides in the North Bay.
Yeah, in Mill Valley, this is one area that floods a lot. The Manzanita parking lot and the shoulder of the Shoreline Highway are always closed during the tides. We'll see the peak of the king tide this morning around 9:30. Meanwhile, in South San Francisco, this is on 280 southbound after Westboro Boulevard. The right lane is blocked by a crash. It is backed up to the Pacifica exit. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Heath Ceramics. Heath's Make Good Market returns to San Francisco this weekend. Visitors can explore dozens of craft vendors along with food trucks from off the grid. Heath Ceramics, handcrafted in the Bay Area since 1948. For the Bay today, some morning sun, a bit of fog, highs in the low 50s to the mid-60s. Inland clear this evening, turning partly cloudy. Some fog could return after midnight. Morning clouds, some fog, Sacramento. More sunshine later today. Sacramento's high 55. No rain forecast through the weekend.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The Somali American community in Minnesota is on edge, with reports of stepped-up immigration enforcement targeting them. Matt Sepik of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
President Donald Trump this week called people of Somali descent, quote, garbage, and said he doesn't want them in the United States. Somali American leaders are urging community members to know and assert their constitutional rights if immigration authorities confront them. The Minnesota Somali community numbers around 80,000, and the vast majority are U.S. citizens.
Matt Sepik reporting. President Trump praised the meeting between his envoy, Steve Witkoff, and son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow. The three discussed a proposal to end Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Speaking to reporters yesterday in the Oval Office, Trump said the Americans were given the impression that Putin wants to end the war.
What comes out of that meeting, I can't tell you, because it does take two to tango. You know, Ukraine, I think we have something pretty well worked out with them. They're very satisfied, considering.
Meanwhile, Ukraine's president continues to shore up support among European allies. A hearing over what can or cannot be admitted into evidence has resumed in the case of the man who allegedly killed UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson in New York City 1 year ago today. Attorneys for Luigi Mangione are trying to get key evidence blocked from trial in his state case. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. San Francisco and Santa Clara are suing the Trump administration over its dramatic changes to federal homelessness funding. KQED's Guy Marzorati has more.
Trump's Department of Housing and Urban Development announced last month that it was shifting funds from permanent housing to shelter. But Santa Clara County Council Tony Lopresti says Congress has already approved millions for Bay Area counties.
The president and this administration are attempting to claim and exercise power that belongs to Congress and Congress alone.
Santa Clara County Supervisor Betty Young says the federal government helps residents pay rent and provides services to people living in affordable housing.
Many of those who have benefited from the county's approach will be pushed back onto the streets.
Federal officials argue that temporary housing and shelter will, quote, encourage self-sufficiency. I'm Guy Marzorati, KQED News.
San Francisco is set to pay $20 million to settle allegations from city employees who say they were penalized for going on military leave. A class action lawsuit accuses the city of failing to provide pay for workers taking military leave or to promptly re-employ some after they returned. Joseph Barton is an attorney representing one of the plaintiffs.
It's been a long time in the making. I can tell you my client is glad that we're reaching the end. We wish it could have occurred sooner, but sometimes that's the nature of litigation.
In a statement, City Attorney David Chu says the city is pleased to come to a resolution. The Board of Supervisors is expected to approve the settlement next week. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from Postman, offering a platform to assist teams build APIs to help API agents make decisions. Postman.com. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. This week in KQED Arts, Arts Editor Sarah Hotchkiss reflects on the best art she saw but didn't yet write about this year, plus a guide to the latest crop of holiday movies. That and more at kqed.org/arts. Support for NPR comes from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, a story of love and loss that inspired the creation of Shakespeare's Hamlet, directed by Chloe Zhao, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists, provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the listeners of KQED. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. It's 8:35 now.
On a Thursday, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. New Orleans is seeing the first arrest in the Trump administration's latest immigration enforcement campaign. The operation is aimed at southern Louisiana, and the arrests came Wednesday. NPR's Martin Costi reports from New Orleans.
The Department of Homeland Security is framing this operation, as it has its previous efforts in L.A., Chicago, and Charlotte, as focused on hardened criminals. In a statement, DHS accuses New Orleans of being a sanctuary city and accuses the jail of releasing, quote, illegal criminal aliens that should never have been put back on the streets, unquote. It says this operation will target immigrants who've been arrested for crimes such as home invasion and rape.
I think it's a good thing.
Walking past Jackson Square, part-time New Orleans resident Sam Puryear is glad to see this operation.
As far as cities with high crime rates, New Orleans is right there on the top. It's young crime, violence with guns. If they can help curb that, they're welcome.
But if earlier operations are any indication, ICE and Border Patrol are also about to arrest a lot of people who have not committed crimes. In Chicago, for instance, the vast majority of those detained by ICE did not have criminal records besides illegal border crossing. As Jean Powers closes up her shop in the French Quarter, she says she's leery about a similar pattern here.
The ICE agents are going to maybe the Home Depots and just certain occupations and really seeking these people out.
And in fact, the first few reports of arrests on Wednesday were at construction supply stores where day laborers gather. So far, there have been only a handful of reported arrests, but the threat of raids is already having a wider effect. Some small restaurants and bars have closed or limited their hours for lack of workers. In the suburb of Kenner, with a big Latino population, Jesse Bermudez says the Latin American grocery store he runs has a shortage of workers and customers.
We do close earlier, and we open areas where people send money transfer offices. We open it later.
He says people here have been lying low since April, when they started seeing reports of immigration enforcement elsewhere in the country. But he says now, with the news of this operation, this store is practically empty. The mayor and police chief of Kenner have welcomed ICE, endorsing its mission to arrest and deport criminals, and Bermudez says that disappoints him.
The majority of these illegal immigrants, they're hard workers. They pay their fair due taxes, and some don't, but at the end of the day, it's not what they make it seem, you know, criminals.
In New Orleans proper, city officials say their policy has been to keep police out of the immigration enforcement business, but they say they don't agree that that's the same as impeding federal efforts. That matters because the state recently passed a law making it a crime to hinder, delay, or interfere with immigration enforcement. Yesterday, the ACLU sued to block the law, saying it's too broad. In the meantime, Elsa Euseda sits at a cash register in a Honduran food takeaway store and shows off her new remote control. From here at the cash register, I can open it and close it, she says, talking about the store's locking glass door. It's for the safety of people who are here inside, she says. They just installed this remote lock, knowing that Border Patrol and ICE were planning this operation.
No, the ICE. Sí, criminales no vienen acá. No, gracias a Dios, no.
It's for ICE, she says. Criminals don't come here, thank God. Martin Costi, NPR News, New Orleans.
The administration has been getting rid of the people who decide if immigrants can stay or must go. They've been firing immigration judges throughout this year, and the ones fired over the past week or so are different than the rest. NPR immigration policy reporter Jimena Bustillo is covering this. Jimena, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
What happened here?
Well, just before Thanksgiving, seven judges out of San Francisco, New York, and Boston received a very short email. It's a generic email that says the attorney general has decided their time with the agency was over. Then on Monday, at least seven more judges all out of New York got that email too.
Okay. And we should note these are people who have worked part of the administration, not the judicial branch. That's why the attorney general would get rid of them. But we said these are distinct or different. How are these people different?
Right. These were more experienced judges. The administration has so far fired about 90 of these judges, and most of them were at the end of their two-year probationary period. This round, we identified 13 who had all been at the agency for longer than 2 years. Targeting tenured judges expands the scope of who could be let go as the administration really looks to reshape these courts. As you mentioned, immigration judges are more like other federal workers. These courts within the Justice Department and under the direction of the president, ultimately, not the judicial branch of government.
Well, why would the administration fire more experienced judges?
You know, it's hard to say. This administration has essentially been doing two things. First, it's put pressure on judges to move faster through a backlog of cases. There are currently nearly 4 million cases waiting for decisions in immigration courts. But the White House has also said that there has been a, quote, lack of integrity in the immigration court system. The implication here is that immigration judges have been biased in favor of immigrants. But fired immigration judges have told me that they don't see it that way. Here's Jeremiah Johnson, who was fired in San Francisco recently.
I wasn't worried about my backlog. I wasn't worried about the crushing load that we found ourselves in at the end. I put that aside in every case I came in and I hurt, and I took the time needed for each case to get it right.
Johnson and many others said that they did not get told specifically why they were terminated.
Jimena, if you were here, you would have seen my mouth hanging open when you said there are 4 million cases waiting for resolutions. Is the administration doing anything to bring on more judges to do that job?
Mm-hmm. They have authorized the use of 600 military lawyers as temporary immigration judges. As a part of the move, the White House scrapped the requirement that these temporary judges should have immigration law experience. Some Democrats on the Hill, led by California Senator Adam Schiff, want to prevent that and have introduced a bill to make it harder to use people without immigration experience as temporary judges. There are currently 25 military lawyers serving in these roles. The problem, critics say, isn't that they're background is military law. It's that they have to digest hugely complex immigration law in a matter of weeks and then make these huge decisions affecting immigrants' lives. Here's Emmett Soper, who was with the agency for 20 years before being fired this year.
It's not something that you pick up right away. And with all of these judges, many of whom are very experienced, being fired, the agency is losing something that it will take a long time to get back if they ever can.
I'm remembering last year Congress tried to hire more judges and Republicans sank that on the orders, the dictation of President Trump. So has the agency tried anything else to just hire more regular judges?
The Justice Department has launched a campaign to hire what it is calling, quote, deportation judges. They did get a lot of money from Congress in order to do that this year. And the hiring campaign offers a pay recruitment incentive for those to work in courts out of New York, California, and Massachusetts. Our reporting shows those locations have been particularly hit hard by the firings.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Time out again for KQED traffic with Mel taking us to Berkeley.
80 westbound before Gilman. A center lane is blocked by some wooden debris. It's causing traffic to back up to about Hilltop Drive. The backup on the Bay Bridge, not so bad now. It's just to the overcrossing. It is, of course, sluggish across the span into San Francisco. 580 westbound slows from Highway 24 to the maze. In Novato, a SIG alert now, 101 southbound before Novato Boulevard. It's backed up to Roland Boulevard. The two left lanes blocked by an overturned crash. Mel Baker for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. I'm Dave Freeman at 843 with a Thursday morning listener perspective. After having back surgery, Kira Sisupan shares about her journey of recovery and playing sports.
I remember walking to the cold, sterile hospital in October of my sophomore year. It was the day of my long-awaited back surgery to correct scoliosis. I slipped into a thin, itchy blue hospital gown and grip socks. It was 6 in the morning, and I hadn't had anything to eat or drink. I wasn't scared or nervous, just ready for it to be over. The process was long and tedious. Blood pressure checked, heart rate monitored, urine tests completed. It took 4 painful tries to get the IV in, each one a sharp pinch. Before they put me under anesthesia, my mom asked the nurses to play Norah Jones, the same music she used to play to help me fall asleep as a kid. The surgery lasted 8 hours. When I woke up, needles, tubes, wires, and machines surrounded me. Despite the heavy medication, the pain was unbearable. I felt weak and tired, wondering what my friends were doing at school or if my dog missed me. Getting out of bed felt impossible. Each step was small but exhausting, yet I knew I had to push myself to recover. For 5 long months, my mom cared for me nonstop. I hated feeling like a burden, especially knowing she wasn't working. Watching her stress over money made me determined to heal faster. 3 years later, I pushed through the challenge of returning to sports, using physical therapy, clinics, and any resource I could find. Now, I'm a varsity starter on my high school volleyball team, and have played 2 seasons of competitive club volleyball, helping my team reach nationals 3 times. My back is no longer an issue, just a scar I often forget is there. Coming back to volleyball and to life after surgery was hard. But volleyball was my passion, the thing that kept me motivated through the pain. Looking back, every moment of that 5-month recovery was worth it. With a perspective, I'm Kira Sisapan.
Kira Sisapan is a senior in high school in California. She loves playing guitar, creating art, and playing volleyball. Support for Perspectives comes from Comcast, dedicated to serving California communities with access to high-speed internet and providing financial donations to help people get online and participate in the digital economy. More at california.comcast.com. Russian President Vladimir Putin visits India today for the first time since launching the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It comes after the U.S. imposed tariffs on India for buying Russian oil. The story on Morning Edition ahead. And coming right up from San Francisco, it's your California Report with Mati Bolaños at 8:51 a.m. And then get ready for 2 hours of Forum starting at 9 from 9 to 11. Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And by the sustaining members of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. New Delhi is rolling out the red carpet today for Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's his first state visit to India since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And as NPR's Dia Hadid reports, the visit is partly an exercise for both countries to signal defiance to the Trump administration.
It's not unusual for old-timers here to hum this when you ask about the relationship between India and Russia. This Bollywood classic goes, "The red hat on my head is Russian, and still my heart is Indian." India has always steered an independent foreign policy, but its relationship with Russia goes way back to when it was the Soviet Union. And that's because India's arch-rival Pakistan was an ally of the United States. And India's engagement with the US is newer. It has been friendly, noticeably in the first Trump administration, like when the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi threw a rally for Trump.
Namaste! Namaste!
But relationships soured in Trump's second term. In August, the administration slapped 25% tariffs on many exports from India and then doubled it, because ever since Russia invaded Ukraine, India has been purchasing cheap Russian oil. There were public tirades, like from trade advisor Peter Navarro, who spoke to Fox News in August. He characterized India's oil purchases this way.
Well, it fuels the Russian war machine. India is nothing but a laundromat for the Kremlin.
A laundromat for the Kremlin. So Putin's visit this week comes as New Delhi finds itself entangled in a war that pits its old relationship, Russia, against its new relationship, the United States. Srinath Raghavan is a historian of India's foreign policy. He says the visit signals
India will not get browbeaten into abandoning or diluting or modulating a relationship simply at the whims of an American president.
The visit is important for practical reasons too. India's military is kitted out with Russian armaments across its Navy, Air Force and Army.
I think a key watch point will be to see if there are any major defense deals that are reached during Putin's visit.
Chetej Bajpayee is a senior research fellow for South Asia at the London-based think tank Chatham House. He says that's important because
there have been no major defense deals concluded between both countries since the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
And he says, don't discount the India-US relationship.
There's very strong linkages and functional cooperation between India and the U.S. So despite the bad blood, India conducts more joint military exercises with the U.S. than with any other country. They've conducted 5 military exercises just this year.
And not all Indians will welcome Putin as his war against his neighbor, Ukraine, rages on. On Tuesday, families of more than 60 men gathered in the capital. They held up signs demanding Moscow return their sons, who they say were tricked into fighting for Russia. Like Surendra Dahiya, on the phone, his uncle Sunil Chaudhary says Dahiya paid $4,000 to a man who promised him a job as a cook in the Russian army.
He didn't know that he was going to be caught and going to the front line and fight for Ukraine. He didn't know that.
The last they heard of him was from September.
Our last conversation was on September 7th.
Dahiya said he was in Ukraine on the front line near Donetsk. And just as Putin is returning to India, Chaudhary hopes his nephew, too, can return home. Dear Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News.
KQED traffic ahead of the California report is next.
In San Leandro, 880 northbound before Davis Street, a stall in the center lane. Traffic is backed up to I-238. In Oakland, this is 580 westbound before Keller Avenue. The left lane is blocked by a three-car collision. It is backed up to 98th Avenue. South San Francisco, 280 southbound after Westboro Boulevard. The right lane remains blocked by a two-car crash. Some injuries involved here, so emergency crews are on the scene. Traffic is backed up to the Pacifica exit. Mel Baker for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Netflix, presenting Apocalypse in the Tropics. The documentary by Petra Costa investigates the fast rise of the evangelical movement in Brazil and the consequences for politics and democracy. Now on Netflix, awards eligible. Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, where a commitment to pure ingredients and sustainable brewing meet a legacy of craft since 1980. Sierra Nevada, taste what matters. Please drink responsibly.
Good morning. This is the California Report. I'm Adi Bolaños in San Francisco. After decades of planning and setbacks, officials are laying the groundwork for something that would be the first of its kind in California, a hybrid campus that houses degree programs from multiple universities across San Diego County. KPBS reporter Corey Suzuki has more.
If you go out to the eastern edge of Chula Vista, you can see this wide expanse of empty land that stretches from the neighborhood towards the lower Otay Reservoir. It's quiet. Flocks of crows float on the breeze. If you strain for it, you can hear the rumble of a distant freeway. For 3 decades, South Bay officials and state lawmakers have been searching for a ways to bring a university here, to this swath of land.
We have a college desert where opportunities are not being provided to families and students.
David Alvarez is a state assembly member for the South Bay. He says higher education opportunities haven't been equally distributed here. Most major cities in California are already home to public four-year universities. With more than 270,000 people, Chula Vista is a major city. It's a majority Latino town, home to many first-generation college students, and one that's at the heart of the San Diego-Tijuana binational region. But if students here want to earn a bachelor's degree, they have to leave town.
It's an investment that's going to really pay a lot of dividends because we're going to be able to have access to education for our families. And then secondarily, we'll create economic activity.
At first, the goal was to become part of the UC or CSU system. At one point, Chula Vista was on the short list to become the location for a brand new CSU campus. But in 2020, the CSU system said they couldn't justify the cost of a new school.
Our key finding is that the projected 2035 enrollment demand alone
does not justify the development of a new campus at any of the five evaluated locations.
That has led officials to focus on a different idea, a multi-university campus that houses academic programs from other universities and community colleges across the San Diego-Tijuana metro. Alvarez again.
You've all been to UC San Diego, or you've been to San Diego State University, or any other number of universities throughout the country or the world. And they're very typical, right? It's the one campus, everybody's the same. But there are other states where they are doing this, where you have multiple institutions on the same campus.
The idea is based on similar campuses across the country. Chula Vista officials are looking at one example in particular, the Auraria campus in Denver, Colorado.
As we were originally envisioned, it was supposed to be a pipeline from one school to the next for students.
Skip Spear is Auraria's chief administrative officer. He says the campus houses the local city college and two separate universities, Metropolitan State University of Denver and University of Colorado Denver. Spear says the idea behind it was to make it easier for students to move between the college and university systems. He says having all three institutions in the same place also allows them to lower costs by combining resources.
You know, a lot of community colleges in Colorado consist of one or two buildings. Here, you're getting access to 150 acres, all the buildings on campus, a much larger bookstore than you usually have access to, as well as different food options.
To be clear, a physical university campus in San Diego County's second largest city is still years away at the earliest. But there is a sense that this new vision is more realistic than previous plans. On a recent afternoon at Southwestern College, many students told KPBS they had never heard about the project. But the ones who have are excited. Jasmine Araujo is a first-year biology student at Southwestern. She loves the idea of having a university campus closer to home.
Southwestern is like a really good, like we have our own nursing program and there's a lot to offer here compared to like other community colleges, and like a lot of them are like much smaller than this campus. So I think it's really good that I want to expand more.
Araujo says she's proud of what Chula Vista has to offer already, but she says it's exciting to think of something new. For the California Report, I'm Corey Suzuki in Chula Vista.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. Monterey Bay Aquarium, inspiring conservation of the ocean through amazing live exhibits and global action. More info at montereybayaquarium.org/connects. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
The California Academy of Sciences says a preliminary exam shows that its beloved albino alligator, Claude, who died this week, had liver cancer, evidence of liver failure, and signs of systemic infection. Those results come as animal lovers are mourning his death. The California Report's Billy Cruz visited a growing memorial at the San Francisco Museum that's been his home for the last 17 years.
Outside the aquarium, fans of Claude are placing flowers and letters next to a picture of the unique creature, who is known for his rare all-white body due to albinism. Homeschool teacher Janine Thomas brought her entire class to the museum to pay respects.
I want to make sure that my homeschool kids care and love our animals, that we are stewards, we respect them. And so we're coming here to honor our respects for this incredible alligator.
The students all have handwritten letters with drawings of Claude. Here's what Ayana Wilson wants the alligator to know.
Dear Claude, thank you for being in our life. We really love you, Claude. Claude, you're all our favorite alligator in the whole world. I hope God is taking care of you goodly, and I love you very much.
Claude had just recently celebrated his 30th birthday in September, which Cal Academy officials say is a much longer life than he would have had out in the wild. For the California Report, I'm Billy Cruz.
And a correction to a story we aired on Tuesday. The San Pablo City Council is set to discuss potential measures to support mobile home park residents at a meeting next week. But contrary to our reporting, they rejected a proposal to consider a rent moratorium at Monday's meeting. 91-year-old mobile home park resident Clara Faria, who is facing a 30% rent hike, says while it's not the outcome they wished for, she remains hopeful.
That's a step in the right direction, because I need the help
whichever way I move, there is no place for me to go.
Still, advocate Rhea Lachlan with the organization Rising Juntos says more permanent solutions are needed to protect residents.
San Pablo residents need permanent tenant protections to ensure they have affordable rents. We can't rely on one-time relief programs or on corporate landlords to do the right thing. So cities must pass these proven policies that work to keep families housed.
We regret the error. And that's the California Report for Thursday, December 4th. We're a production of KQED News. I'm Adi Bolaños. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Stay with us if you can. Forum in a minute. Here's Mel with traffic in San Jose.
Some good news. This is 101 south, northbound just before Hellyer Avenue. It had been blocking all the lanes. They've gotten just two lanes left in the right side of the roadway that are still blocked by gravel from a gravel hauler that spilled its load earlier today. And in Novato, 101 southbound before Highway 37. Traffic is still sluggish back to DeLong Avenue, but a SIG alert has cleared there and a two-vehicle rollover crash removed. Mel Baker, 4 KQED.
Traffic support from Murphy Mechanic Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum at UC Davis, featuring Sahar Curry, Weights and Measures, and a January 20th.